Hello and thanks for joining us. I'm Carol Jenkins and the podcast is Black America on the Brink. We take a look at the issues facing Black America and what we need to do to make the best of it. It's an extension of our award-winning CUNY TV program, Black America. Our guest in a moment. Dr. Christina Greer is an associate professor of political science at Fordham University, and she is also a distinguished fellow at NYU's McSilver Institute for Poverty Policy and Research. She does a great video podcast called The Aftermath on OZY.com, and you can regularly see her analysis on MSNBC and hear it on WNYC Radio. She's been a guest twice on Black America. We are, you know, Christina Greer fans. We love you. Thank you for being with us
today.
Thank
you so much for having me.
There's a lot to talk about.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I'm a political scientist. I've been, you know, it's been a slow year.
I watch you every single day. I mean, they bring you in to tell us, you know, where do we go next? You know, yeah. the title of this podcast is Black America on the Brink.
On the brink.
I have to ask you, I say, listen, guys, I didn't say it was good or bad.
Right. You know? and some days I think it's great. And yeah. Other days, I think, you know, we have cause for worry and concern. So, you know, I think about some of the organizations that are doing fantastic work, you know, fighting back against this particular president, this particular administration, this moment, you know, the Republican Party, the laissez-faire Democrats. And, you know, there's so many organizations and young people who are really about it. We're on the brink of something great, you know? And then sometimes you wake up to a tweet and it's like, we might be on the brink of a nuclear war.
There is that. Listen, we're going to talk about, you have a book you've already written that it's out, it's talking about Black immigrants, and mm-hmm. I want to talk about that a little bit later. But in reading your bio, it tells me that you're writing a book about the people, Black people who ran for president of the United States, and I'm your average poorly educated person.
Oh, goodness.
At PS 140, they never told me that there were 60
yes.
people who ran for president of the United States who were Black. Tell us a little bit about that before we launch into.
So I've been thinking about this project for quite some time, and it's not just people who have been nominated by a particular party, usually a third party. I call them alternative parties to the Democrat and Republican Party, but people who have been asked to run. And oftentimes they said, no, thank you. But, you know, they've either been nominated or they've actually run. And so essentially from kind of Frederick Douglass to Obama is like the bookend from 1872 mm-hmm. to 2008, if you sort of see Barack Obama's the golden ticket for sort of Black political electoral action. And so when I started collecting these names, it was largely because when Obama was running in 08, so many journalists would say on television or write in print, you know, Obama, the first Black man to run for the presidency. It's like, no, he's the first Black man to secure the nomination from a major party for the presidency. But, you know, most people could rattle off Shirley Chisholm, Jesse Jackson pretty
right,
easily.
Precisely. Those are the ones I know.
Yeah, but, I mean, you know, keep in mind, Al Sharpton, you know,
right,
spoke
Al.
At the DNC in 2004.
Yeah.
He was on the stage pulling everyone, including John Kerry, to the left. I actually teach his DNC speech in my presidency course because he gave that speech two nights before Obama gave his very famous 2004 DNC speech. And I think Al Sharpton's DNC speech blows Barack Obama's speech
out of
the water.
He was magnificent. He was magnificent.
And the sad thing is he's talking about all the issues that we're still actually fighting about today. Marriage equity, D.C. statehood, you know, right to earn a wage, a living wage, decency and respect, you know, racial equity. I mean, the list goes on and on about sort of the concerns that he had in that 2004 speech. And unfortunately, they're all on the table again.
Exactly. Now, we have those three, Shirley Chisholm, that we adore, mm-hmm. and Jesse Jackson, who put up a really good fight, Al Sharpton. That's three.
Don't forget about Dick Gregory, Edward Brooks from Massachusetts. You remember Black Republican senator from Massachusetts? You have Angela Davis was nominated. Coretta Scott King was nominated. I mean, these are people who didn't accept, but, you know, and don't forget, you had Carol Moseley Braun, Cynthia McKinney. These are also elected officials.
Right.
So when you start looking at the list, and, you know, some of the names are obscure, but just because they didn't quote-unquote win, I refuse to think of them as losers, because in the book, the framework that I'm setting up is that, you know, all these people who ran or who were asked to run and participate in electoral politics in any capacity, they did some really important things for Black America. Primarily, in this country, voting is a two-stage process. You have to be registered first, and then you can vote. And so when you think about someone like Jesse Jackson in 84 and 88, he registered over 2 million people each time he ran, to say nothing of bringing in other people who worked in his administration, right? So when you think about David Dinkins, the first and only African-American mayor of New York City, right? He was Jesse Jackson's New York State finance chair. Same with Mayor Wilson Good, first Black mayor of Philadelphia. He worked in Jesse Jackson's campaign. So that's obviously, these are sort of big names. You know, Donna Brazile, all these Black leaders across the country. But when you look at these more obscure candidates who ran on these, I call them alternative parties, you know, even if they brought in, quote unquote, only 5,000 people, you know, Black folks have only been voting in this country with, you know, under the full protection of the law, with an asterisk, right, the 1965 Voting Rights Act, for 50 years. So to have someone introduce a family to either a particular issue or the idea of parties, right, multiple parties, or the idea of registering before they even go out to vote, you've now made someone participatory. And even if that candidate drops out, then now you've motivated this person who most likely stays in the political sphere in some capacity. And they sort of become part of, I would argue in the book, a participatory family. I always say voting is hereditary. So if you weren't participatory, someone inspired you, brought you into the voting process, you're now registered. They may have dropped out for the presidential race, but when the mayor's race comes along, you're now registered.
Right. Right. Well, this is fascinating. It's called symbolic candidacies. So some of them were symbolic and some of them were real.
Some of them were very real. I mean, you know, you think about Jesse Jackson sort of changing the rules of the nomination process for the Democratic Party. You know, you think about Shirley Chisholm really bringing in, I would argue, you know, a conversation of intersectionality
before Kimberly Crenshaw.
Before Kimberly Crenshaw. I mean, you know, and obviously Kimberly Crenshaw is, you know, well-versed in politics and law. But I think, you know, a lot of the discussions and debates that we're having, you know, as Black women with other white women right now, you know, we can easily trace back to conversations that Shirley Chisholm had when, you know, she ran for president, and Bella Abzug and Gloria Steinem were saying, well, we want a woman on the ticket. And, you know, all the Black mayors and, you know, everyone from the Indiana conference where they all, you know, gathered said, well, we want a Black person on the ticket. Shirley Chisholm goes to the white women and says, well, I'm here. I'm ready. I'll do it. And they're like, by woman, we meant white woman. And then she goes to the brothers.
I think Gloria supported her, though, you know, but.
To a limit.
Yes.
And
but
then,
I think she
and
supported.
Then moved on. And same with the Black men. When she went to the Black men and said, well, you know, you want a Black person on the ticket? Well, I'm ready. I'm here. Yeah. And they said, no, by Black, we meant Black male. Yeah. So
I always tell people to watch Shala Lynch's documentary about Shirley Chisholm. It makes me cry every single time.
And I was on a panel with Shala maybe last year, and she was screening, I think, a different documentary. But I kept going back to, you know, I know we were there to talk about something else. But I asked her, I said, do you really know how great this documentary is? Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, they still screen it at the Schomburg. I just feel like a whole generation of students now, or people who weren't really paying attention, and especially now that we no longer have Shirley Chisholm with us, I just feel like I feel like it gets more and more important every year.
So do I. Unbought and Unbossed by Shala Lynch. Just a terrific, following her as she fought to run for president of the United States was so alone.
Yeah.
The Black men, you know, who said to her, get in line, you know, we've got to have a Black man first, you know, and as you point out, white women who had other ideas. But
then, you know, part of what I talk about in the book also is, you know, you bring people into the political fold. So Representative Barbara Lee is interviewed in that documentary where she says, I was a college student. I wasn't registered to vote. I'd never voted. You know, I'm going to school part-time. I knew nothing about politics or anything, you know, related to electoral politics. And she was inspired and motivated. And now she's a member of Congress. You know, so, I mean, just thinking about the legacy.
And she had a child, too.
Yes,
right,
she was a single mother at the time.
Yeah.
And so, you know, just thinking about the ways that these candidates pulled people in different ways. And even if it's just giving them a moment of dignity, right? I don't think that that should be lost to the history books just because they're not one of the 45.
So let's talk about current events, Miss Political Science, because I said to you before I left for Las Vegas and L.A. for the marches, I said, am I going to see you there? And your answer was an emphatic no, babe, no, not me.
So no hats for me.
So let's talk about that. This, when you talk about the black women, white women divide, that was present in the 2017 march and still to some degree in 2018. Tamika Mallory, who's, of course, one of the four women organizers of the march, the big march, addressed this population in the Sam Boyd Stadium on Sunday and said, I know there are a lot of black women who are not here today and they're not following her. She says, I can't take it personally.
No, but because I have nothing but respect for Tamika. And, you know, we sometimes run in similar circles.
Right.
And Tamika and the rest of the organizers, I have nothing but respect for their organizing prowess, their vision. I mean, I think ideally it's a fantastic entity that they've put together. It's sustaining. You know, they're registering people to vote while they're there.
A million people they want to register this year. The power to the polls, right?
I mean, the hashtag power to the polls was trending. I mean, these are women who are setting a new 21st century blueprint of what organizing looks like, right? From an environmental perspective, from a gender perspective, everything. I mean, it's multi-class, multi-racial. I get it. I respect it. I'm encouraged and inspired by them. That being said, I don't feel the need to participate. I feel like 2016, I busted my hump working, you know, on these elections, making sure I'm trying to educate people. Part of, you know, my self-care is to not run around and be everywhere. But also, you know, I'm still insulted and hurt that white women consistently vote against their interests and, you know, sort of look to black women as the saviors and the cleanup women. And, you know, and Tamika mentioned it, Cecile Richards mentioned it in her speech. It's like, black women aren't coming to save us. Like, stop it. They keep saving us, but, you know, we can't keep doing things assuming that black women will be the keepers of democracy the way we have been for several generations. And so for me to go out and possibly risk pneumonia wearing a pink hat and sort of this, for me, it's faux sisterhood, right? I'm not feeling it right now. I just feel like, you know, you had 53% of white women voting for Trump. You had 63% of white women voting for Roy Moore. It's like, when will you learn your lesson? You're not. And I think that white women need to do a lot of the heavy lifting, talking to their own sisters and their own mothers and their own brothers and uncles and dads to sort of really do the hard work. They're not going to listen to me. So until I see that level of hard work, I'm good. I support the leaders. I support women who go. You know, I give pocket change for, you know, people. There were some organizations raising money for people to go across the country. I totally support that financially and, you know, spiritually. But I don't think that that's the best use of my time.
So how do we approach this divide? I mean, it hasn't, the needle doesn't seem to have moved all that much in the year. Even though there were like a 1.6 million people marching in L.A., there were like 500,000 people, mostly white.
Yeah.
Some people of color, but mostly white. How do we bring people together? What's your analysis? I mean, Cecile, as you say, you know, in her speech, said, "Come on, white women, we've got to do better than this."
And as the head of Planned Parenthood, I think she's been doing, you know, obviously a great job of trying to complicate this conversation. I mean, there was a sign that that sort of came across my timeline that really affected me, because I think these are hard conversations that aren't necessarily happening wide scale. I'm sure they're happening in some sectors of the women who attended the march. But it says, feminism without intersectionality is white supremacy. And I think that some women are marching thinking it's all about feminism. And if that indeed is the case, then all you will do is get into power and replicate white male supremacy once you get there. Because that's the model. That's what we've seen as leadership for the most part, you know, as a country. And so without these really hard conversations about intersectionality, class, and race, especially, then white women are looking for something, you know, where it's just, so once you get into power, you'll continue to treat black women as second-class citizens. And that, to me, is just not acceptable.
Yeah. Well, and we saw that one group of Black Lives Matter, well, local group, refused to go because they felt that the people in Las Vegas were endorsing the Democratic Party and that mm-hmm. they are pulling back from, you know, there's got to be more than Democrats and Republicans mm-hmm. and, where do we go from there? How do you feel about that? I mean, an ineffectual Democratic Party is the way I would assess it now, and a Republican Party that's totally out to lunch.
Yeah, I think that's a hard one, right? Because I always tell people, I think that, you know, for our democracy to work, it has to be a combination of protest politics and electoral politics in conjunction. It can't just be one or the other, because obviously we need protest politics to put pressure on our elected officials, and we need electoral politics, you know, to change policy. So not participating because, you know, I never saw that it was explicitly endorsing Democrats. But, you know, I understand we're obviously arguing against Trumpian Republican policies and de facto saying we're supporting many women Democratic elected officials.
Right.
I mean, the thing is, you know, unfortunately, there's no mention of parties in the Constitution, but unfortunately, the way the vast majority of our states, local, and, you know, cities and towns have mm-hmm. shaken out, it's a two-party or a one-party system, right? And so most of our towns, it's actually just, you know,
right.
a single party. And then statewide, we really just think in terms of red and blue, Democrat and Republican. So I hear the concern.
Yeah, the reluctance to engage in things as they always have been.
So, yeah, and the status quo is definitely a two-party system. I think that, you know, we might see in some small test cases where independent candidates are going against a Democrat and Republican. And I really do think locally it depends on the level of frustration, right? Because we have a lot of lazy Democrats as well. I mean, you know, lots of incompetent Republicans, but lazy Democrats who are coasting to reelection consistently because it's a one-party system. Or, you know, they know that people aren't really watching the store. So, you know, you see them voting with Republicans at times where I don't think that they should be. You know, I mean, my sort of biggest frustration I'm always railing against on Twitter is Senator Kaine from Virginia. I find him to be utterly useless as a Democrat. Like, you consistently vote with Trumpian policies, you know, for his judges. I mean, it's just like, what is the point of you being a Democrat?
What did you think of Doug Jones, the Black women of Alabama who sent him to the Senate?
Yeah.
And
well, you know, what worries me is that, you know, had it not been for the massive write-in campaign that I know that lots of local activists really worked hard on, and Reverend Glasgow out of Southern People's Movement, I know he was really in Alabama, really instrumental. I know the senior senator of Alabama said, you know, that he wrote in a respected Republican and sort of gave the wink and the nod for a lot of Republicans to go ahead and write in. I mean, what worries me is that when you take out the number of people who wrote in a particular candidate, Roy Moore wins. So it's not like Doug Jones has a mandate. It's literally Black women being the keepers of democracy to make sure we don't fall off the precipice, that we don't fall off the brink. But, you know, the mandate in Alabama by no means is for Doug Jones. And when he's up for election, I believe in 2020, right? Or is it this year? I can't remember.
This year.
This year he's up. You know, I don't know if he'll make it. You know, I mean, if the Republicans put up someone who's not a pedophile with a 40-year history of sexual assault, I think that Alabama will go back to the natural trend that they've had.
Well, let's move to the state next door, Georgia, which has a fantastic possibility.
You're
Stacey Abrams fan. She's running, running for
my sticker
governor,
and everything.
Governor, you have your sticker? Governor of Georgia.
Georgia.
And I hear, I just saw Kimberly Peeler Allen last night, one of the co-founders of
Higher Heights
for America, supporting Black women running for office. She thinks that Stacey has a good shot.
Oh, I think she definitely does. I mean, here's the sad part. If Stacey Abrams were a white male, there would be no question that she would be the next governor of Georgia.
What is that, because of Yale and, I mean, what her credentials
I mean, her
for?
Her credentials, she's been a lawyer.
Yeah.
She's a small business owner. She's been registering people to vote. She's a master of policy. She's the House Minority Leader. I mean, like, you name it, she understands the rural-urban divides. She understands the suburban needs and concerns, urban sprawl. I mean, any issue that you would hope a governor has mastered, she's mastered. And the only thing that, you know, is causing some people to have a question mark are black skin and ovaries, right? So, I mean, this intersectional conversation. But there is no doubt in my mind that not only would people in the Democratic Party jump out if she were a white male, I think Republicans would just say, you know what, we'll just take a mulligan on this one and we'll wait around in another 8 years.
Sure.
So, I mean, I'm cynical, right? You know, I'm a political scientist. I've seen so many politicians and just so not impressed ever with anyone. But this is the first time, and I wrote this, you know, I have a weekly column in Amsterdam News, and I wrote this a few months ago. I have not been excited. You know, in 2017, it was really rough politically, and lots of people were depressed and concerned and flat out worried and scared with, you know, what was going on in D.C. and with our executive branch. And this race has made me renewed and excited about the possibility of the quality of candidates that we can actually have represent us. And, you know, when I hear Stacey talk, I mean, her master of policy is just bar none. The frustrating thing for me is that, you know, this is my personal opinion, I just don't think the Democratic Party is throwing everything behind her with all of their might, right? There's a white Stacey in the race. And I think that deep down, the Democrats don't think that this brilliant black woman can win across, you know, a statewide election, because we've never had a black female governor in the history of this nation. But I think she can do it. And I think that there are a lot of people in so many counties across Georgia who initially, you know, would say, I don't know, and kind of the Obama effect, where they hear her and they're like, this woman gets me.
Would the black vote alone do it?
Oh, no. But, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, you know, she's not counting on just black people. I mean, she's not trying to be the governor of just black people. I mean, the concerns and policies that she's talking about, you know, if white folks in Georgia actually vote for their interests, not racism, right? As LBJ said, you know, all you have to do is convince a poor white man that he's better than, you know, a Negro, and you can pick his pockets all day long. I think, you know, there's so many white people in Georgia who are recognizing it's like that strategy for their pocketbooks is not working. And when they hear her level of understanding of their issues and their concerns, and not just their issues, but like she's actually thought about the solutions, right? And so she actually has these like multiple point plans where it's like, oh, no. I've been thinking about, you know, your lack of jobs. I've been thinking about how your school system's been crumbling. And, like, let me show you my multi-point plan of how policy in my power as governor.
Exactly.
And she also, here's the thing, as a legislator, keep in mind she's been a minority House leader for, 10 years? As a legislator, she knows who she's up against. Right?
Right.
Not only does she know how government works, unlike our president, but she actually knows the players.
So what's wrong with the Democratic Party? A friend of mine.
How much time do you have?
I know. Well, a friend of mine who is, you know, your average citizen watching cable news calls me up every day and says, what is wrong with the Democrats? Why can't they mount an offense, a defense? Where are their words? Where are their position? What's wrong? What do you think?
Well, I mean, the Republicans are, you know, they're two things. On the one hand, they've been ahead of the game as far as messaging and organizing and capturing all these state houses for years, right? The Republicans control two-thirds of the state houses, two-thirds of the governorships. So the red wave has been slowly but surely coming in, and Democrats were too busy high-fiving themselves by electing a black man for 8 years that they weren't paying attention to the store, right? And so it's like we've got mayors as Democrats, and we had this president, and that was pretty much it. And so the Republicans are in a weakened position because they have someone who, A, they can't control and he doesn't understand policy. But that also makes it much more difficult for the Democrats, right, to play offense or defense because Trump is a moving target. And so many people would argue, then don't play offense or defense with him. Like, he's, you know, you can't trust him for his word. He's a white supremacist. So how about you all come up with ideas, right, your own ideas, separate from this man? And the problem is, our Democratic Party is very diverse. We have factions, too. We always look at the Republicans and say, like, oh, my gosh, look at all their factions. We've got factions. Just because you're a Democrat doesn't mean you're progressive. There are lots of more conservative Democrats. So when you have someone like Tom Perez, who's the head of the DNC, who initially came in and said, you know, all Democrats have to be pro-choice. It's like, slow down, Tom Perez. You know, I'm the most pro-choice person, you know, on the planet.
Sure,
I get,
sure.
Like,
yeah.
I'm fully, fully, fully pro-choice. However, I do recognize that Democrats in, say, Missouri or the few lone Democrats in Alabama or Georgia or wherever they may be, may not be able to take my New York City Upper West Side pro-choice stance. It might have to be a little more nuanced because that's how you get votes, and especially for single-issue voters. So my biggest frustration, this is political scientist Chrissy Greer talking, my biggest frustration is that the Democrats, for me, have an opportunity to be the party of LBJ. And I know that, you know, that's a taboo word because he messed up in Vietnam and, you know,
sure,
this, that, and the other.
Sure.
However, I don't, for the life of me, understand why Democrats don't say, hey, guess what? We're the party that gave you the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, the Immigration Act, the Housing Act, like poverty, like you name it, we created it. We're the ones who are the inclusive party. This has been 50 years of us, ride or die, pulling people into the party.
Well, there are a lot of Americans who would oppose that just on that fact alone.
But there are a lot of folks who want them to just say it.
That's how Donald Trump got elected.
But, I mean, he also has,
because
like,
he wasn't
30
he for the immigrants.
Like, yeah. Well, he's rolling back the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, and the Immigration Act.
Right.
But, you know, I don't understand why Democrats don't say, you know what? We are not the party of white supremacy.
Right.
We're not.
So you say a full force that you believe that Donald Trump is a white supremacist.
Oh, yeah.
The evidence.
No, I mean, listen, I've got receipts for 40 years, so I don't even flinch.
So what, to put the show in context, we're recording this right after the U.S. of A. shut down and reopened. I mean, we had 3 days of no government whatsoever. Did the Democrats just fold on? How do you explain?
I think, unfortunately, people like Chuck Schumer still think that you can negotiate with someone like Donald Trump and also someone like Mitch McConnell. Mitch McConnell has shown himself to be a liar, just like Donald Trump. You know, he's adopting a lot of the qualities of Donald Trump. And so for Chuck Schumer to say, okay, we'll reopen on the promise that you'll bring this vote. It's like, really? Like, he brought up that vote for Merrick Garland, right? You remember him?
Yes.
Who's nowhere to be found?
Yes.
Right? And so Mitch McConnell's not to be trusted. And I think it's fascinating when you look at the Democratic senators who did not go along with Chuck Schumer's
only
plan.
Only 18, right?
Well, only 18, but these are the 18 whose names are being floated around for 2020 because
yes,
they're the quote-unquote progressive Democrats.
Right.
Which brings us back to, you know, not all Democrats are progressive. There are lots of people who are like, listen, keep this government open. DACA will figure itself out. And there are those of us who think that, you know, CHIP and DACA are of the utmost importance, and we cannot negotiate with these men who they're not to be trusted.
So you think Schumer folded?
I think Schumer folded, and I think we'll be closed down on February 9th.
So, and then after that, this sort of week-by-week running of the United States government is the way of the future?
Yeah, I mean, I hope not. I pray not. You know, I really do think that wiser heads will prevail, because at a certain point in time, public opinion will show that, you know, the majority of Americans will probably start to blame the Republicans, right? You can't keep saying it's the Democrats as obstructionists if you have the majority votes in the executive or the legislative branch. You control the executive, and ostensibly you control the judiciary as well. Like, you can't keep blaming the minority party that has no power, right? I mean, as we've seen. So, I mean, in the past, public opinion polling has shown that the party in power is usually the party that's blamed. So the Republicans would take heed to remember that, just because the base for Trump is loyal. But, you know, don't start messing with people's money. They will turn on you.
Exactly. So part of the of this podcast, in addition to going to the brink, is so how do we survive? What advice would you give to, and I know there is no such thing as monolithic. What advice do you give? What are the things on your list that you tell everybody? Listen,
yeah,
you gotta do X, Y,
right,
and Z.
There are a few things. One, read. You know, and not just Twitter and Facebook and Instagram, right? Because we now know that those sources are corrupted,
being used against the
government.
Yeah,
and also
yes,
it turns into navel gazing to a certain extent.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you tend to follow people who say things that you agree with. Because for me, I don't follow people who say white supremacist things. It's not good for my spirit, so I don't do it. So I recognize that my Twitter feed is very much a progressive, left-leaning Twitter feed. So, you know, reading books, you know, there are people who research a lot of these questions, right? In my husband's a historian, so I mean, he's fascinated by Google, right? Because he says, in this day and age, there is no reason why you should ever say, I don't know.
Exactly.
Like, we literally have millions of volumes of books at our fingertips on our smartphones. So I would say, you know, do some deep dives. You know, and I always tell my students, I'm like, a little less Real Housewives, a little more, you know, picking up
a little more Patrice Kahn colors. Yes, you know,
exactly. You know, you know, when we think about, you know, when folks are saying, like, wow, are we about to, like, enter the third Reconstruction? Like, what does that mean? If you don't fully know what the first two Reconstructions meant, and you haven't read W.E.B. Du Bois' Black Reconstruction, right, maybe you might want to just peruse what one of the greatest social scientists in the history of the world said about these things. You know, there are letters back and forth between Weber and Du Bois. I'm like, that's fascinating. There are letters back and forth between Du Bois and Booker T. Washington, really tussling about this idea of Black exceptionalism and, you know, model minority status. And, you know, and like, these are questions for Black America, especially, you know, as we think about immigrants, and many Black folks are immigrants and don't really think about it. You know, Caribbeans who are here fourth or fifth generation.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you and Opal Tometi, one of the founders of Black Lives Matter.
And the executive director of the Black Alliance for Just Immigration.
Exactly.
I'm on her board.
You're on
because
her board,
I,
right?
I
that is such terrific
the work.
Work
that she's doing. I mean, talk about, again, another organizer who is thinking, you know, someone reminded me the other day, it's like, we have to start thinking the way our great-grandparents thought, which is generations ahead, not weeks ahead. Right. And so our great great grandparents, you know, for those of us who were descendants of enslaved Africans in America, you know, when they were enduring some of the most horrific experiences that our minds physically cannot imagine. Right. They weren't thinking about the day to day all the time. I'm sure sometimes they were. But like, there had to have been a vision of what their great-great-grandchildren could be. You know, and this T-shirt that I see nowadays that's really popular, it's like, I'm my ancestor's wildest dream. You know, it's like they possibly couldn't even think about, you know, Carol Jenkins and her own podcast television show.
Oh, wow.
Brilliant
or
Black
Christine
woman mentor. I mean, but, you know, like, in all honesty, really thinking about the ways that, you know, we can read about our past to help, A, unlock some of this confusion, but then also give us motivation to keep going.
Yeah, I was struck by Melissa Harris Perry, who spoke in Las Vegas, mm-hmm. and she was telling the story of her father and her uncle, who were twins and brilliant.
Oh, yeah. You her know, father was a professor at UVA.
Right, and that they always told the family story from these brilliant Ivy League-educated two men who created this family. And what she said was so moving. It really brought me to tears that it was actually their mother, her grandmother, mm-hmm. who was a seamstress, mm-hmm. that's where the family started. Mm-hmm. And that was the vision. And that was what, mm-hmm. I mean, when she worked and let them go to school when they
right.
couldn't earn money to put food on the table or to heat the,
right.
you know, the
and
home
think,
that they lived in.
I think that, you know, that's also to see the story, but also ask that question, the story behind the story, right? When you see someone brilliant, it's like, so you probably came from someone who worked from, you know, can't see in the morning till can't see at night,
exactly,
right?
Exactly, right.
Whether it was your grandmother, your great-grandmother, your great-grandmother, someone. And I mean, I do a lot of work with the Tenement Museum. And what I love about this exhibit they have called Your Stories, Our Stories is you upload an object that sort of is representative of your immigration or migration story. What I think is so powerful is that people from across the world are essentially sharing the same story, right? So you're a first generation Chinese immigrant and you have this dictionary and you say, well, my mother used this dictionary when she was working at, you know, as a seamstress. And then someone else has a dictionary. It's like, well, my Irish great grandmother used this dictionary when she came here and she was a seamstress. I mean, so these are, and she spoke no English. I mean, like, these are the same stories that we can share, you know, and sort of have some commonality. So back to your question, though. So reading, taking time for yourself. You know, I've been trying to get better at staying off of Twitter. Before, I used to wake up and immediately read it before I went to sleep. And it's like, that's not good for you to sort of, we have to consume the news because we should be reading the paper and knowing what's going on.
We should be informed.
We should be informed for sure. But, you know, this inundation of chaos is essentially what this particular president feeds off of, and I don't actually have to subscribe myself to the level of chaos. So really controlling when I digest news, you know, and I always go back and forth with my family because I don't like to watch the news while I eat. I think it's a bad idea. And they're like, well, this is the time where we're going to catch up on news. And it's like, I don't think that we should be listening to this negativity while we're putting things physically into
right.
our bodies.
Right. So self-care.
And then, you know, I find, and this goes back to an old principle that I'm sure, you know, your parents and grandparents subscribe to, no matter what your circumstance, you know, whether you needed assistance from others or the government or whatever, there's really something powerful about giving back to others. And everyone has the capacity to give back, no matter how dire your circumstance. And so I've been trying to be a lot more active, one, with my political tithing, which is giving to young candidates, candidates of color, female candidates, to get them to that next level. So, you know, really thinking about the ways that, you know, a lot of Black folks are very well versed in donating money to the church, but not necessarily to a political candidate, and really building that into the family budget to give money. So
I like the concept of tithing, political tithing.
Yeah, you know, because the way you would tithe right. to the church, weekly, monthly, whatever it may be, like this is, you know, this is a sustained, this isn't a 4-year, you give some money to one person. This is a sustained process so that we can cultivate good talent. And then, you know, really being a mentor. And that can take different shapes, you know. But I think recognizing that we all have something to give and really finding people that we can connect with others and help them get to whatever level it is. And part of it could just be, you know, taking 10 minutes and asking someone, like, what do you, like, where do you want to be next year? You know, if you're complaining about your job, what can I do? Is it looking over your resume? Is it making a phone call? Is it helping you do a little bit of internet research? Is it just sitting here and helping you create a vision board? I don't know. But, like, thinking about this idea of a connected mentorship where we're all lifting each other's boats, right? I mean, not to sound trite, like, you know, she's not heavy, she's my sister. But realistically, if I'm carrying your backpack and you're carrying mine, then it doesn't feel like we're carrying any backpacks.
That is fantastic. And what a wonderful way to close out our podcast, Christina Greer. Fantastic. I know that you're telling us not to assume that we should have Twitter on all day, all night, but we can read you on Twitter. What's your...
So I created my hashtag before I, or my my handle before I fully understood what Twitter was a few years ago. It's @DR_CM Greer. So it's @DR_CMGREER.
Okay, great. We'll make sure to read you when we're not having dinner, though.
Yes.
But thank you so much for this conversation.
I always love talking to you.
We just love you here. And we hope we'll have a chance to talk with you again.
Okay. I'll be back.
Thanks for being with us for Black America on the Brink. Watch our award-winning television show, Black America, on CUNY TV. And thanks to our crew, Executive in Charge, Susan Iger, producers Audra West and Christy St. John, engineers Jack Horowitz and Sarah Fishman. Our music theme is by Tyreek Keys Washington. And we come to you from the radio studios of City University of New York. Let's talk again soon.